we talk about the elephant in the room, pests. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, June 10th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Westerners can forget just how destructive the giants of the savannah can be. But an elephant never forgets. We talk with Bethany Brookshire, author of Pests, How Humans Create Animal Villains. She gives us the definition of a pest and discusses how Kenyans deal with the 6-ton threats to their farms. Then, the pests of South Dakota. The State Game, Fish, and Parks Department unpacks how they manage beavers, coyotes, and prairie dogs. We explore the damage these critters can cause, as well as their roles in the prairie ecosystem. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Think about the last time you interacted with an animal. Perhaps it was with a beloved pet, or a bird singing its tune high above your head. Maybe you saw a butterfly. Or maybe it was a less pleasant experience. Maybe it was a Canada goose decorating the sidewalk in the way Canada geese do. Maybe it was just a glimpse of a rodent, or pigeon, or snake. Maybe you came across a pest. Bethany Brookshire is a journalist and author of Pests, How Humans Create Animal Villains. I connected with her via Zoom.
You know, it's interesting. You could start like anyone starts a college essay. You know, the Oxford English Dictionary defines the word pest as, and truly the word pest does have its origins in like the 14th century. But really, I have come to see the word pest as applying to an organism, like an animal usually, that is not harming us directly. It's harming our stuff. It's harming something we value, right? A predator harms you directly, right? Like a shark, a great white shark, that is dangerous to you personally, right? A rat does not generally attack you personally. It attacks the things you value. And the things you value can be, you know, food. Like a rat will absolutely eat your food. But it can also be things you value, like your sense of control, your sense of safety, your idea that your house or your city should be a place that is clean, right? They attack our values and the things that we own. And they make us question things about ourselves. And this is a problem because humans, above all things, really hate introspection. And so we hate pests. And we often go, wow, this animal is making me uncomfortable. How do I kill it?
No. This is in your book. I know this is not your direct research, but there is this lovely chart in the introduction that is from Nias.
Philip Nias, yeah.
Nias, yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that chart to us like you did in your book?
I love a good chart. So, yes, this was actually from a review that he wrote. I want to say it was a 2018, possibly 2016. Let's say 2016 review. When he was able basically to kind of put human-wildlife conflict, so the ways in which humans and wildlife come together into kind of a three-dimensional 8 cubes of human judgment, right? So basically most graphs, you have your x-axis, which is like the horizontal one, and then you have the y-axis, which is the vertical one. This one also has a z-axis, so it's like coming out at you. So it's a cube, right? Okay. Is the concept. And the axes are things like how frequently you encounter the animal, how negative that encounter is, and how severe it is, right? Okay. So one of these areas, one of these kind of octagons, it wouldn't be a quadrant because there are 8 of them. So it would be an octagon. I don't know if that's a word. Anyway, one of these cubes.
Yep. Okay. 8
would
cubes.
Be something. Well, yeah. One of these 8 cubes would be something that you encounter very frequently. It's very minor and it's positive. Okay. A butterfly. You encounter that frequently. Mm-hmm. It's minor and it's positive. You like it. It makes you happy. Or a robin in a tree. You're like, oh, look, it's a bird. Like, it makes you happy. Other cubes could be things like predators. You encounter them very, very rarely, right? Mm-hmm. When you do have that encounter, it is negative. Like, if you are bit by something, that is negative. Mm-hmm. And it is severe. You do not survive that encounter with a grizzly bear. Right? So that's another
opposite
quadrant.
Of a butterfly. Got it.
Quite. And then, of course, there are quadrants that are things that you encounter very rarely, but the encounter is extremely positive. So, for example, that would be me finally getting to snuggle a wombat, which is something that I've literally always wanted to do. And that would be in that quadrant for me. But pests get their own quadrant. And that is a quadrant of you interact with them frequently, right? Mm-hmm. The encounters are negative, but they're not severe, right?
Okay.
So you have, like, for example, in my case, I have this squirrel. His name is Kevin. To be fair, there are about 20 of them, at least. They are all named Kevin.
Okay.
Because I can't tell them apart. So they're all named Kevin. And Kevin lives in my yard or around my yard. And Kevin eats all of my tomatoes. And he does this every single year.
Mm-hmm.
And it drives me absolutely bananas, like beyond all explanation, the rage that I feel. And this is a very frequent encounter. It is very negative. But let's be honest, I can buy tomatoes at the store.
So it's right? Minor.
Kevin, yeah, it's minor. Yeah. Kevin, to me, is a pest. Is it a pest that I have now erected a 8x5 foot steel cage to prevent? Yes. But again, as I mentioned before, this squirrel, Kevin, mm-hmm. his actual name, I probably can't say on the radio because it contains
this
a curse word.
This is public radio too.
Yeah. So it's effing Kevin for those who
have not read the book.
Yeah. So effing Kevin, effing Kevin has cost me a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. A lot of time. Anguish.
A lot of time, a lot of anguish, but it hasn't directly harmed me. Kevin harms my perception of the world. Kevin harms my idea that I'm this gardener who can just up and grow my own tomatoes and like be in connection with my yard and my plants and stuff. And Kevin, you know, basically laughs at me and shows me that nature is giving me the finger. And so Kevin is not a predator. Kevin is a pest. And what I found really interesting and what I ended up writing this book about was kind of why we approach these animals the way we do and what that says about us. What does that say about what we value, what we want out of our environments that we get so bothered by these animals?
And how do elephants meet the pest requirements? Because that was, I think, probably the most eye-opening part of your book for me.
Yeah, that was, it was a fascinating chapter to write. So basically, I approach the idea of pest through different themes. Mm-hmm. And these are the different ways in which humans encounter animals and judge them, right? Mm-hmm. So you can judge them like rats through like fear and loathing and disgust. You can judge them like we judge coyotes or wolves, which is a lot about power and fear. And then you can also judge animals based on your beliefs. And mm-hmm. so I was interested in elephants because many animals that we call pests commit harms to things that we value, right? Maybe they eat our livestock. Maybe they eat our tomatoes. Others do very similar harms, and yet we are not mad at the harms those animals do because we have beliefs about them that are so strong that they make us see what they do in a completely different light. They make us kind of dismiss their harms or decide they need to be dealt with in a different manner. And so the example of elephants was really fascinating. I got to go to Kenya to report on human-elephant conflict in and around Kenya, most particularly around Masai Mara mm-hmm. and around Tsavo National Park. So people in the West love elephants because mm-hmm. they're beautiful. They are stunning. They are amazing. Like mm-hmm. seeing one in the flesh is very emotional. But elephants are also hungry. They're really hungry and they're very large and they like a lot of the same foods that humans like corn, because everybody loves corn, right?
Yep, universally beloved. Speaking to someone in South Dakota, yes.
Sure, big fan, corn. So people in Kenya grow corn. They grow it for their own subsistence. And when they do, elephants can smell the corn and they come and they're like, wow, you grew us all this corn. Thank you. So kind. And because elephants are so large, a single elephant can take down a family's entire season's worth of produce in a night.
Oh,
a single
my gosh.
Night. They knock down fences. They knock down houses. And if you are in the way, they will knock down you. And in Africa, about 200 people die every year as a result of human-wildlife conflict with elephants specifically. Millions of dollars in crop losses and everything else. And those are the people who die. That's not the people who lose their subsistence livelihoods. These are not rich people. These mm-hmm. are not people who have their legs crushed. These, you know, and are living with the consequences of that. And so they cause a lot of conflict. And it got so bad, actually, that at one point, after I had just reported the book and right before it came out, several farmers set up a protest and they started burning tires as part of their protest across the Nairobi-Mombasa highway. And you have to understand, in Kenya, there are only two highways and one of them is the one from Nairobi to Mombasa.
Okay.
And they blocked the entire highway with these burning tires to protest the fact that the government was not helping them with human-wildlife conflict. Those farmers were shot.
Oh.
By their own people. By their own defense forces in Kenya for protesting human-wildlife conflict.
I cannot imagine that happening here if we had a similar animal attacking our farmers and impacting our agriculture. Agriculture is a huge deal in South Dakota.
Of course, yeah.
Impacting that industry. Wow.
And I mean, that it really speaks to what role elephants play in Kenya. And mm-hmm. because in Kenya, the role of elephants is dictated not by Kenyans necessarily.
Okay.
It is dictated by people like us. Because we are the people who want to go and see those elephants. We are the people who contribute 10% of Kenya's gross domestic product in tourism dollars to see elephants. We are the people who want to see them in documentaries. We are the people who pay large amounts of money to charities and trusts in Kenya that will preserve these elephants. And it is based on what we believe about them. And it's not wrong, right? Like mm-hmm. elephants are endangered. They are wonderful. They are important keystone species in that ecosystem. They're absolutely necessary. And we should absolutely conserve them. Mm-hmm. But the way they are conserved and the value that is placed on them then serves to devalue the people who experience conflict with them, right? Mm-hmm. The more value is placed on those elephants, the less value ends up placed on the Kenyans who actually suffer from their harms. Well, the way people in Kenya in particular deal with human-elephant conflict is really inspirational and yeah. important and great, because they look for non-lethal ways to deal with these elephants. And they look for those ways because we value those elephants, mm-hmm. right? And so they do all this amazing research and they build things like beehive fences.
Say more about that.
You know, people think that elephants hate mice. That is not actually true. Elephants do not hate mice, in part because elephants can't really see mice. They're mm-hmm. they're too small. That's a vestige of Pliny the Elder. We can blame Pliny the Elder for a lot of things. But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
What elephants actually hate are bees.
Huh. And
you would think, if you were an elephant, like, your skin is 2 centimeters thick, you know, like mm-hmm. you would think it would be fine. But no, see, because they have the tips of their trunks, they have their eyes, they have their mouths. If you think a bee getting in your face is bad, imagine a bee, an African honeybee, right? They're angry, going up your trunk, which is 2 meters long.
Oh,
oh, absolutely not.
Mm-mm.
No, no. And so elephants, when they hear the sound of bees, scientists learned from the Maasai, actually, who live in Kenya, that elephants would run from the sound of bees. And they were like, well, that's useful. And so they just started building beehives around farmers' fields and convincing bees to move into the beehives. And this works really, really well, actually. Oh. You can also sometimes play recordings of bees, and that will also help. As long as the elephants don't realize that it's not real bees, because if they figure out it's a recording, they're just like, screw it. So there are also very large amounts, miles and miles of electric fences going up all over Kenya to stop elephants from getting near crops. And that's both good because it is non-lethal. It's also not necessarily great because it's restricting where these elephants can go, right? Yeah. And like, restricting a lot of their like historical migration patterns. And of course, people really, the thing about elephants is they are very smart. And I have seen video recordings of elephants taking trees, like tree trunks, and tearing down electric fences with them because the wood doesn't conduct the electricity. They have also figured out their tusks do not conduct electricity. And so they'll do that too. Utter genius, honestly. You kind of have to stand. But it's very interesting to see people work very hard to find these non-lethal ways to deal with this conflict. And it's troublesome and it's expensive, but it's also really inspirational because we could do that too.
Yes. Right? Can you kind of get into how farmers here could maybe take some lessons from how elephants are managed in Kenya?
I mean, I am not a farmer and I would not presume to tell any of them what to do with their land or their money. But I can say that there are some really great programs out in the West. I was looking at some in particular in Oregon, where they are looking at non-lethal predator prevention methods. And these include things like electric fencing. They include things like livestock guardian dogs, which are really, really useful if you have sheep, pigs, chickens, et cetera. And basically it's Pyrenees, Great Pyrenees is a very popular breed for this. And they can live out with your livestock. They don't need to come in. They, you know, they can just stay there. And they will guard whatever you tell them to guard. And they do a very good job. There's also, you can, you know, people do work on horseback riding their borders, to prevent wolf predation, for example. One farmer who I spoke to, she had lambs and sheep, and she just started playing the radio over the pasture at night. For a while, it was just rap because that was the only thing that she could get on the radio. By the time I talked to her, I believe she was getting NPR.
Good.
But it solved her cougar problem. Because the cougars wouldn't respond to that. They wouldn't go near the sound of human voices. Right. And so there are a lot of these methods that can often be more long-term effective than, you know, calling the trapper. Right. Mm-hmm. But also it should be noted, this was a grant program. This was a specialty program for a county, right? Like in many places, the trapper is free. None of these methods are free.
I imagine a Great Pyrenees would be kind of expensive.
They are a bit, and you got to train them.
Yep.
Right? Like, so it is an effort and it is a difference, but I think it's one that could be made if that is what people decided they valued. But I do understand why it is hard to value that, right? Especially because many of the people I spoke to who were farmers dealing with predator impacts in the West, like these aren't those big expensive, like ranchers with 20,000 head. These are people with 8 head of cattle, right?
Yeah.
Losing one matters a lot, right? They've got like 20 sheep. Losing one matters. And so, you know, I absolutely understand the anger and the grief and the frustration. Right? All of that work. Like, I'm angry because of my tomatoes. I can only imagine if it was a cow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I can't judge what people decide to do. Right? And I understand why people make the decisions that they do.
Did you personally undergo like a mindset shift when you wrote this book?
You know, I did, to some extent. I definitely keep your cats indoors. That's please do that. That's one mindset shift. But the other one is I found that so often when we find an animal that bothers us, like me and Kevin, effing Kevin the squirrel, we respond out of anger. We respond out of frustration. We never respond with curiosity. And what a difference does it make when you respond with curiosity? Like, I did end up building a garden cage, yes, but you know what I also ended up doing? Installing a water fountain, because it turns out that squirrels will steal your tomatoes when it's really hot and dry out and they're dehydrated. They want the water. Yeah. The fountain worked, actually. Yeah. I ended up installing the cage because of a groundhog who I've named effing Keith. to differentiate. Yeah. So I found that when I start having conflict with animals or wildlife or weeds, I'm asking myself why. Why is that animal here? What does that animal want? And what do I want? And how much does that matter? Right? Responding to these animals becomes much more effective when you start thinking of it in terms of curiosity and asking why an animal is here. This is especially true for rats, right? People often want to poison or just kill rats. They don't question why the rat is here when the answer is that giant dumpster behind the restaurant that is open. And like, you know, it's right there. Just saying. So I think the biggest thing I learned was approaching these things with curiosity and recognizing that we live in an ecosystem and that ecosystem is going to have wildlife in it. And it's up to us on how we deal with that, right? We can decide that we want to exert the iron fist of control, and good luck will never win. I can tell you that. Or we can say, maybe we need to live a little bit differently and come to some different understandings and learn about the animals that are making it with us.
That was Bethany Brookshire. Her book is Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Before the break, you heard a discussion on pests, and a particular pest that Kenyan farmers deal with. So let's meet a few of South Dakota's elephants. Greg Woolbrink is a wildlife damage specialist with South Dakota's Game, Fish, and Parks Department, and Brad Baumgartner is a regional wildlife manager with GFP. I spoke with them via Zoom about coyotes and beavers.
I think beavers play a big part in the ecosystem because they create a lot of wetlands when they make dams. Certain places, you know, like especially in pastures, they can cause water, or they can create some water sources for cattle, which can be a good positive thing. Wood ducks absolutely love them. you know, they definitely have their place in the ecosystem.
A super cool animal. When you walk up to a beaver dam, it's a mecca for wildlife. They're, you know, like Brad had mentioned, that wood ducks, it's not uncommon to have a pair of ducks sitting in that pond and all the other little animals that coincide with it.
And there's a lot of animals that look to cross those dams at night too. And it's amazing how many different critters would utilize the dam to cross a creek. And otters really like beaver dams too. And they really hone in on those areas because it's like a fish trap for them. And that's where they prey on a lot of their fish. So
what are some of the negatives of having a beaver, especially close to landowners?
I always kind of refer to beavers like this. I don't know if you've ever watched Jurassic Park, and it was the third episode, and they're down in the creek, and the Stegosaurus goes walking through the creek, and they're going, ooh, ah, that's how it always starts. And then later there's running and screaming. That can be beavers. I've had a lot of people that would, you know, when I was in the field, call me up and like, hey, I got some beavers. And, oh, cool, just leave them alone. A year later, they're calling me, oh my God, I got beavers, you know, and they cause a lot of damage really fast. I mean, it's not just at the speed that they can create a dam, but it's at the speed that they're able to chop down trees. And when you have, oh, for example, CRP trees on fabric that are established in maybe 8 years old, eight-year-old ash trees, for example, on fabric, I've gone and looked at those where it's gone right down the row in every tree that you planted, or maybe even older than that, 10, 15 years, 70-year-old plus cottonwood trees, you know, girdled, and they fell those over, and yeah, they can do a lot of tree damage really fast, and they are very, very good at burrowing too, and their tunnel systems are, well, they're a rodent. They're in the family Rodentia, and that they will burrow into the side of the bank. They'll have a lodge, but they have a lot of bank holes. And one time I had a request for service that I was working, and they wanted to tear the dam out, and they had a backhoe there. And I said, you know, while you're at it, maybe you should dig up, you know, this bank hole here and cave, you know, pack it in, you know, so the next pair of beavers doesn't move in and go, hey, home, you know, and move in. And as he was digging that up, I couldn't believe it. It was about 100 yards long on the bank, had several holes going into the water. So they cause a lot of damage with that. You get them in like crop fields, for example, they'll hollow that burrow out. And I've seen combines drop a tire into those and literally just bury their combine, one part of it into the bank holes. I've seen roads collapse. We'll do the same thing and burrow along the cement foundations of old bridges.
I had one last fall where the beaver had created a lodge, a home, with these burrows that Brad's talking about, right on a county bridge. And they asked me to come help them out so that they could repair the bridge. So I asked the contractor who was out there, how much is this repair going to cost? And it was like $22,000 to fix that road right alongside the bridge because of the damage they caused.
I seen some one time that had 4 5-foot culverts plugged up in Brookings County, and they were so plugged, and I'm telling you, they pack them right in the middle, so they're not easy to clean out and dig back out, and it is a tough job. But they had plugged it up, and the water was coming over the road. It looked like the Sioux River, and it was just a normal creek.
So if you come out of your home and you find that you have a new beaver neighbor who is maybe not being very considerate, what are your options to help manage that?
Well, there's some preventative things you can do if you mm-hmm. have trees and you know that you have beavers. I mean, we always highly recommend people, you know, use some heavy mesh wire and wrap it not tight around the tree, give it some room to grow and high, like at least 3 feet, if not 4 feet high. That is probably the best way to save your trees. But you know, sometimes it's just not feasible. I mean, there mm-hmm. are times when you have hundreds and hundreds of trees. So, you know, we have told people in cases like that, you know, they could mow along there if they want to keep up with it and put like electric tape fence low to the ground, and the beaver, you know, would come up out of the water wet. And so it'd get a, you know, kind of a zap and, mm-hmm. you know, keep it away from the trees. So that's another way you can kind of prevent them. So
what are the misconceptions around beaver management that you see in the public?
People are amazed that we even have beaver. A lot of people who haven't been around this job don't understand how many there actually are on the landscape. So when they see one, you know, a lot of production producers, like the crop farmers, who have creeks on their property, they've dealt with them enough over the years. But it's like the acreage owners that have a small acreage with a creek nearby, and then all of a sudden there's something cutting their tree, and they have, you know, we're out in the prairie. It's not like you think about beaver populations around here, that we have a very strong, vibrant beaver population. And so that's probably the biggest misconception out there, is that we just have a lot of them.
So now I want to move on to an animal that most people, I think, have seen or at least heard in this area, in the southeastern part of the state, and that is coyotes. What mm-hmm. is their role in the prairie ecosystem?
Coyotes, you know, a lot of people maybe don't understand this, but coyotes actually prey really heavily on mice and rabbits. Their main diet is rodents that way. So, I mean, they do help control some of those populations, and You know, that's a good thing to have around.
Something cool about coyotes is they're very opportunistic predators. You know, they'll take a cottontail bunny, they'll take a field mouse, they'll eat watermelons, they will climb up and get berries out of a tree. I've seen where coyotes were just eating grasshoppers in, you know, late summer when the grasshoppers are bouncing all over and they're huge. They love those things. But unfortunately, when they decide that they want to go after the you know, the lambs or the calves, that's when we come in.
Their diet changes throughout the year. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of, I look at it like a almost spring, summer, fall, winter diet. It changes just about every cycle for the most part.
So what are the negatives of having this animal around?
If you're a cattle producer or a sheep producer, or sometimes even poultry producers, I mean, they can be your worst nightmare, especially sheep producers. I mean, coyotes have been killing sheep since beginning of time. I mean, it's what they do. They're very opportunistic, like Greg said. And while, you know, mice and rabbits might be their primary diet, I mean, if they sense, you know, calves being born, whatnot, they usually are in there for cleaning up after birth. That usually leads to an opportunity where they'll probably take a calf here and there. And when that starts, you know, then people call us for help because it can get pretty serious, especially with some high dollar calves. And sheep, they'll just never stop. You know, I mean, it seems like when they take calves, I've kind of noticed like there can be a reason, not always. It can be heifers and they've never defended, you know, or had a calf before. It can be a regular herd of cows, but maybe it's the firstborn or the lastborn, and usually the firstborn, the mothers aren't really in protective instincts yet. Sometimes it's a cow with twins and she can't defend them both. You know, when it comes to coyotes killing calves, it a lot of times takes two. One of them will harass mama cow while the other one just starts biting at it, and it's pretty harsh. And I mean, if you're a cattle rancher, you know, they're pretty protective and they like their calves. And I've come up to a lot of them where they've called me and the calf is with its hind quarters eaten out and it's still alive. You can tell a lot of times they'll pull the ear off, they'll pull the tails off, pull them down by the nose, and they just kind of keep eating at it until they kill it. Sheep, it's different. Lambs, I mean, they bite them in the throat. And I've never actually witnessed it, but I've had sheep producers tell me they have, and they said that within less than 3 minutes the lamb was dead. I mean, they can kill them that fast. They'll come back night after night after night in sheep, and they just don't stop. They won't stop. And usually, you know, they're feeding pups, and it's an active breeding pair. And a lot of times you'll find it's a third one that we call a babysitter, which is like one of last year's pups. And it's usually what we call a dry female. And we call it the babysitter because it actually takes an active role in killing for the pups as much as the parents do. Greg and I could talk for hours about them because we worked with them a lot. And I tell you, I got more respect for coyotes than any other animal out there. They are the smartest animal in North America, bar none, in my opinion.
Why do you say that?
They can overcome and adapt to anything. I mean, I used to always say, I mean, if there was ever a nuclear holocaust, the cockroach and the coyotes would survive. I mean, they can just overcome and adapt about anything.
Here's an example, just to the level of their ability to see what's in around them. Their abilities to see changes in their environment is uncanny, where farmer goes into a field with a tractor or his pickup, it may not be a problem, but then a strange pickup shows up or a strange smell shows up, that coyote is now on high alert, and any little change out there, it just completely changes its behavioral patterns.
Is there anything that can be done for prevention?
You know, that's the hard part is they can climb fences, they can dig under fences, their favorite time is in the middle of the night when everyone else is in bed. You know, moving your sheep up next to the house or putting them in a barn is some of the best methods. It's the old educated coyotes, and sometimes keeping the population young helps. Ultimately, if there's a coyote in the neighborhood that decides it's going to start killing some calves, that's problem. That's a problem coyote, and we're going to have to probably trap that coyote or hunt it, or you're not going to stop it.
The coyote, it'll never screw up twice, if that makes any sense. So if somebody, for example, will call that coyote in and take a really bad shot at it, it's now what we call educated, and it will never come back to that call. It's over. They're just that smart that way. And like Greg was saying, I mean, we've seen over the years where I call it adaptation and change, where you've seen differences in coyote behavior as technology goes on. I mean, it used to be like nobody'd use a mouth howl. Actually, it was one of our guys that claimed that he was the first one to ever invent it to call in coyotes. Well, pretty soon everybody's got mouth howls, So coyotes kind of started not responding to calls. Well, pretty soon everybody got electronic calls, and everybody was blowing the same call too much, or playing it too much. Well, now, as technology goes on, we've seen a lot with like thermal scopes and thermal hunting and thermal imaging, which is, people using those at night to shoot coyotes. I have one of my guys reporting now that, what you used to see with coyotes killing, livestock 1 to 4 in the morning, they're avoiding that. And he says they're popping up 10 in the morning. He says, when nobody's around, they're wait till after the farmer's fed his cattle and he's gone back, and now nobody's around and he's taking a mid-morning. That's how adaptive they are.
So, how do you hunt or trap an animal like that?
Well, I mean, it takes a lot of skill, and this is what I always tell people: if they were a dumb animal, my guys wouldn't have a job. This is why we do what we do. And usually, when you get down in the southeast corner, our coyotes are highly, highly, highly educated. And I mean, for example, when I had a district, I had Brookings County, the SDSU research sheep right there on the Dairy Avenue, right north of Brookings, would get hit by coyotes all the time. And those coyotes literally live right in city limits, and it's very, very hard to go after them. So we involve a lot of methods, no matter what it takes. It could be snaring, foothold trapping, calling, shooting, walking them down when we have tracks in the winter, M44 cyanide guns that we've used, not around populations, but out more western South Dakota, airplanes. We do have USDA APHIS that we work with to help us with aerial coyote control. And am I leaving anything out there, Greg? Any other thermal imaging,
Yeah,
ambushing them at night?
we also employ specially trained coyote dogs. A lot of our wildlife
Right.
damage specialists will have dogs that help them locate decoy dogs, tracking dogs, and the like.
What would people be most surprised about to learn about the coyotes in our own backyard?
There's a sizable coyote population in the city limits of Sioux Falls, and
Really?
occasionally they cause some problems, but these coyotes will do things like they don't howl, they don't bark, they keep quiet, they don't come out, until it's nice and dark and no one can see them. We have a lot of coyotes, and a lot of people wouldn't, like, well, I never hear a coyote in Sioux Falls. Well, it's because they've learned if they're gonna be in town, they better not howl, otherwise someone will come see what's going on and pester them. So yeah, they're just that adaptable.
I mean, we've had some right here at the outdoor campus where when coyotes have a den, it's only when they have pups in the spring of the year. Coyotes, the rest of the year, they're not like a fox, where a fox has a den year round. So a coyote will only have a den when it has pups, or it may go into a hole or something during severe weather, or if it's got mange, real bad and it's cold out. But I think it was about 2, 3 years ago, we had a lot of calls where people were walking their dogs around the outdoor campus here, and there was a coyote that would always come out to them. Well, coyotes are very territorial that way, and they're threatened by other canines. And so it was coming out, and it wasn't attacking them, but it was making itself known that, hey, you're getting too kind of close to my den. And I don't know where the den was, but I'm sure it was within 500 yards of my office here somewhere. Most people have coyotes and they don't even know it. I mean, they're everywhere, and they're just highly adaptable, and they are a very, very smart animal.
That was two specialists with South Dakota's Game, Fish, and Parks Department. Greg Woolbrink is a wildlife damage specialist, and Brad Baumgartner is a regional wildlife manager. You're listening to In the Moment on SDTV. I'm Alan Kester, in for Lori Walsh. For our last pest today, the prairie dog. The animal shapes both the land of western rural South Dakota, as well as who can live in these areas. Mike Klosowski is a regional wildlife supervisor with the Game, Fish, and Parks Department. He connected via Zoom to introduce us to the prairie dog.
It plays quite a bit of a role in today's ecosystem. Oftentimes folks call them ecosystem engineers. And that's because they're out there digging their little holes that so many people don't approve of. But those holes provide shelter for a lot of other animals. You know, good examples of that would be burrowing owls, black-footed ferrets, rattlesnakes, badgers, all kinds of critters on the countryside really depend on that area that they have created. In short, the biodiversity increases in those dog towns just because of all the different critters that either prey on prairie dogs for food or have been provided shelter because of their existence with the burrows.
Yeah, so where do they fit in on the food chain? Who are they prey for?
They are on the bottom of the totem pole. Everybody is utilizing them for food. All the animals pretty much that are predatory in nature have them on the menu at some point, it seems like. But, you know, coyotes would be a good example. All raptors, you know, raptors, whether they're eagles or raptors that are migrating through during the spring and fall migrations, or the highly rare black-footed ferrets that need survive. Without prairie dogs, they simply don't exist. They go extinct.
So where does the conflict with landowners come from?
Yeah, so the conflict is pretty straightforward, and that is prairie dogs, when they're out there on the pasture, out on the Great Plains, out on the native sod out there, they eat grass and forbs. And essentially, that's the same thing that cattle eat as well. So in short, they are reducing forage out there in the pastures for cattle, and that's kind of where the rub happens right there, especially during times of drought where, you know, grass is at a premium, where folks are really looking at ensuring that their operation is going to be in the black for the year, and that's where it can be a little bit challenging. Also, too, when they are out there, you know, engineering those burrows, digging holes, essentially, it can be hazardous for cattle. And then also, if you do have a introduction of a weed seed of some sort in the area, that can also reduce that soil, and you can potentially have some weed infestations as well. So a few different things.
So what happens when we have too many prairie dogs versus too little?
So too many prairie dogs, even, you know, too much of a good thing is too much of a good thing. In situations where you have, you know, consistent drought, where you have populations of prairie dogs increasing to a level that's not sustainable for the land, they can essentially strip a piece of prairie pretty bare and really not have much for forage, not only for prairie dogs, but also for cattle. And in those situations, what has to happen is they have to start pioneering out and moving to a different area where there is forage. So it can get to be challenging when forage is at a premium and you're in drought and you know, producers need that grass for cattle.
Is there a way to prevent having a prairie dog come on your land?
You know, there's quite a number of historical references of prairie dogs being all the way from Canada to Mexico.
Wow.
And they've been here for a very long time, a lot longer than we have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's really necessarily a way to prevent a prairie dog from coming on your property if you live in prairie dog areas. One thing you can do if you have prairie dogs and you want to limit the spread of prairie dogs in those areas is well-managed pastures, grasslands. If they are well-managed and you do have, you know, moisture that is sufficient to be out there and helping a lot of those grasses grow, can significantly reduce the amount of acres that they spread to. So in a pasture that is very much overgrazed, those prairie dogs can be very challenging and start to pioneer out and spread out. In a pasture where there's considerable grass left, even that has been grazed by cattle, those prairie dogs are less likely to be pioneering out, and they are more likely to stay in their original area.
So what are some misconceptions around how you manage prairie dogs?
There's quite a bit to managing prairie dogs. They're a very controversial topic. Mm-hmm. In the early 2000s, there was some concern about them going extinct and a lot of different conversations nationwide. And with that, state of South Dakota around that 2003 timeframe created a prairie dog management plan. And essentially what we want to do is we want to ensure the existence of prairie dogs. With that being said, we also don't want to have landowners taking on the full burden of having mm-hmm. prairie dogs on their property. State of South Dakota, we have a minimum objective around 200,000 acres of prairie dogs. That's what we want to see out there on the countryside. Our last survey was in 2020, and there was an estimated amount of acres of 303,000 acres of prairie dogs. So we would be above that at this time.
Yeah, so does that open it up to hunting then, for example, or trapping?
So prairie dogs would be open for prairie dog shooting statewide at any time, essentially. There is no closure. Now, if we were to get to a situation where we were below objective and prairie dogs were, in fact, you know, populations decreasing and we were concerned about their populations, we'd have to have some more additional conversations about what that looks like in terms of not having a hunting season or, you know, not having a prairie dog removal program through the state for landowners that are affected.
So if a landowner does have a problem and they call you up, what do you tell them and what help can you offer them?
Yeah, so state of South Dakota Game Fish and Parks is mandated by state law to assist producers in a number of different situations that have prairie dogs on their property. Typically what that looks like is if prairie dogs have encroached onto private property from adjacent public property onto private property, in that situation, if that population on that private land has grown to above 10 acres and it's within 1 mile of that public land, Game Fish and Parks hires a number of contractors per year that will essentially go out, look at what they have going on in terms of prairie dogs encroaching from those public lands and see if they qualify for the program. If they do, we send a contractor out there and we will actually poison those prairie dogs on both the public and the private land out to 1 mile in that situation. The poison that's used is zinc phosphide, which essentially is the same poison that you can buy, say, at Runnings or a Tractor Supply where you're looking to poison, you know, things like rodents in your yard or something along that line. So the contractors that we hire, they are all certified by the state, and they have to follow the protocol that's set aside for that poison. And zinc phosphide has a very specific protocol of what they can do, when they can do it, and where that poison can be placed.
So it's a highly managed system.
It is a very managed system. There are rules, guidelines that Game Fish and Parks, in addition to the contractors that they have, as well as private landowners out there on the countryside of South Dakota, whether they're working with Game Fish and Parks or managing prairie dogs themselves, there's very much regulations that they have to follow.
That was Mike Klosowski, Regional Wildlife Supervisor with the SD Game Fish and Parks Department. And that was our show for today. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.